the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, welcome to another episode of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast. Special Wednesday interview edition, as always, brought to you by the Mighty ShakePay, show sponsor. Great sponsor, I got to say. You know, we use the app. We think it's the best place for Canadians to buy and sell, although you should never sell Bitcoin. And they got a low spread, great mobile product for all you phone users. Pretty sure everyone just uses it on their phone. I never use it on my desktop or Mac or anything like that. Everything I do is on my phone now. Yeah. So if you use our promo code to sign up, CBP, Charlie Beta Peter, you can be immediately rewarded with $30 on your first $100 Bitcoin buy, which is pretty good.
You know, we have to try shaking our computers, load it up on a desktop, shake the computer and see if it works.
Sir, I will not. There are too many moving parts, sir. That's not an option for me. I'm not replacing this computer. So we got the shaking sats as well. Like Len mentioned there, you shake your phone once you use our promo code to sign up, and you can get a couple of sats sent to you every day on the house free of charge. Just hand it over up to 1,000 a day after 200 straight days shaking. And finally, the sats back Visa card, which is a no-brainer, I think. Now that I'm back meandering out in the world, I have been using it more and more. Shoppers Drug Mart, Fortinos. I may use it at the mechanic on Friday. We'll see. Very, very good stuff from our friends at ShakePay. So check them out. Today we have a guest who is not yet with us, so we'll continue to delay, like, you know, Wayne and Garth when they became cable news stars on our cable network stars on the show.
You know, there's one topic that I'd love to scrape your brain here. What happened today with El Salvador? And it looks like they're going to be delaying the issuance of the Bitcoin-backed bonds, which is kind of curious, the fact that they were saying it was oversubscribed by as much as 50%. For them to go about and say, we're going to hold off because of volatility in the market, it seems kind of strange to me. I don't know. What are your thoughts?
It was a bit weird. Our friend Massa is a TradFi whiz, and so he was telling us that emerging markets have been kind of weak, and there hasn't been a high bond issuance in the last little while, and so this is maybe the right time to delay. I don't know enough about that. Probably on Friday's Spaces, we'll talk about it some more, I would guess, because he's a guy with a great voice on that kind of stuff. So I'm interested in hearing what he has to say. I would like to get him on this program. I haven't pitched him the April 6th empty slot yet, but we'll see if he's interested in coming on, talking to us a bit about bonds, TradFi, and the Bitcoin angle for the traditional investment crowd. So our guest today is Chris Belcher, who's working on the CoinSwap implementation on top of Bitcoin. He just showed up in the green room. Yeah. This is our first foray. I'm going to bring him in here and then I'll introduce him. Chris, it's good to sort of meet you. I appreciate your anonymity, true to the Bitcoin mission, of course. Chris is, as I was saying, he's a man with expertise in a topic that Len and I think pretend to know something about when it comes to actual knowledge of the implementations of you know, privacy mechanisms on Bitcoin. It's a little over our heads, I'll be honest, but it seems to us, and we've mentioned this before, that this sort of thing is becoming more and more important in Bitcoin and finance more broadly. So Chris, we're happy to have you, man. How's it going?
Thanks very much for having me. Yes, it's going fine. Just to check, can you hear me very well?
Oh, yes. You sound great, yeah.
That's good. Yeah, it's going fine, I guess. Yeah. So, interesting thing going on these days, isn't it?
Yeah. Especially what happened in Canada for the last month or so. I mean, certainly privacy is now coming to the forefront in the Bitcoin world, and bringing you on is quite an honor because we could pick your brain about this particular topic. And before we really dive into it, tell us a little bit about yourself. I'm sure you just don't stumble upon doing some sort of project like your CoinSwap project. So how did you how did you get into the Bitcoin world? Tell us a little bit about yourself before we really dive into things here.
I got interested in Bitcoin a couple of years ago. It's a bit stupid. I was interested in using it to trade like virtual gold, you know, on things like World of Warcraft and that kind of thing. That was my first introduction. I could see how useful it could be. And the privacy just seemed like an unsolved problem, something interesting to work on something that was important. And so I worked on that for these however many years it's been.
Is it
You were talking about the thing. I was just thinking, for a long time, I was thinking about how would, say, someone in China who wants to use Bitcoin, you know, without the Chinese Communist Party locking them up, how they accept donations privately. That's always a fun topic to think of, that kind of stuff.
I do like that. And my question for you, maybe you just answered it. You know, it seems to me that a lot of the people in the Bitcoin world, whether it's on the content side, the technical side, working on code and you know, implementations like yours and others, seems to me there's always a moment where they find themselves in a situation where they need something. And so necessity becomes the mother of invention in that way. Do you have a moment like that? Or are you just a sort of, you know, white hat doing a good job for the community because you saw a need and wanted to solve it?
Yeah, well, I suppose everyone needs privacy in many ways. It's the thing that everyone all the time needs. Like, if you have the way Bitcoin would work, if you didn't improve privacy, was that everyone could see everyone else's spending all the time. So, for example, you could go to buy some coffee at a shop and the people serving you would immediately know all your income, all your spending, all your savings, everything like that. And that's just unacceptable. So that's immediately obvious when you like examine how Bitcoin works back in, especially several years ago when I got started. So it's like an obvious problem that needs solving, really.
Not to mention that, you know, Len gets two shots of Starbucks honey syrup in every coffee that he gets. So that would be a dead giveaway as well. Yeah, you know, we can't have that getting out there. Anyway, Len, sorry, go ahead.
Gotta hide that. Yeah, that's anyway. But one thing I want to talk about is some of the various projects you're working on. Could you talk about your CoinSwap project and maybe anything else that you are working on currently?
Sure. Yeah. So CoinSwap is what I'm working on most, like basically full time these days. So CoinSwap itself is a protocol that was first invented in 2013 by Greg Maxwell, and it's a way of improving privacy, which works by swapping coins. So say you, the user, would give your coin to someone else, and someone else gives a different coin to you, and therefore anyone who examines the blockchain will see that these coins seem to teleport. That they seem to end up, I'll put it another way. So right now, if you looked at Bitcoin, you'd see the transactions, they're going from A to B. They go, every transaction has an input and an output, and that's like a graph, you call it in mathematics, you can join them. But if people are using CoinSwap, then that becomes not possible, because a coin that used to belong to someone, I don't know, A, now ends up in a completely different place somewhere else. So CoinSwap improves privacy by breaking the transaction graph. That's kind of the building block. Now, the actual project, like I've called it Teleport, because it involves loads of other things. So you have to privately learn your own balance in history, and then you have to privately connect to the other people that you were doing a coin swap with, and you have to mundane things, like you have to have a wallet which gives you a new address for every time you send coins into the wallet and that kind of stuff. So there's a whole, like, there's this protocol of coin swap, and then there's a whole bunch of other stuff you also have to have to be really private. Now, for other projects, I invented this project called Join Market a couple of years ago now, and that was I think is the first widely used implementation of CoinJoin, and that's another privacy protocol where multiple people come together and cooperate to produce one Bitcoin transaction, which contains all of their transactions within it. So it's called CoinJoin because it joins the transaction graphs, and that was the reason it's called Join Market is because back in the day when I came up with it, there was a big problem of how we get all these multiple people to cooperate. Like if I want to send some coins here and you want to send some coins over there and a third person wants to send some coins in their own place, how do you actually get them to agree to come to one place to do one transaction at the same time with all the right fees? And the answer, that the reason it's called Join Market is because that solves the marketplace. So you have people who, or well, they're bots, they're computer software that hang around and they're always turned on and they have Bitcoins, and you, the user, can go to these. They're called market makers. And you, the user, in the terminology or market taker, you can go and connect to these people, to these softwares, and create a coin join that sends money exactly to where you want to go, like whenever you want. It's a good user experience. So like I imagine on like a smartphone application, you click a button, send, and exactly at that moment, your wallet will connect to these people and create a coin join, and that will be that. And it'll be exactly the amount you want. You know, $5 or $10 or one Bitcoin or whatever you want. But in return for this user experience, you have to pay a small fee. So the reason these people are having their bots turned on and they're on 24/7 like a server is because they can earn a very, very small fee all the time. So it's a bit like, it's similar in these days to how people run Lightning routing nodes. The reason they run them is because they can earn small fees for about it. But actually, Join Market did it first a few years ago. Now, another project I've done is called Electrum Personal Server. And that came back from a few years ago when I was thinking that I really liked the Electrum wallet, but a downside was that it sends all its own addresses to some server out there on the internet. You don't know who it is. It could be anyone. And they can spy on you very easily because you send them a list of all your addresses and they have to send back all your transactions and like which is the next address to use, which means they have all your information. Like it's a really unprivate, kind of not very good way of doing things. And Electrum Personal Server is an implementation of the Electrum server, but that's really lightweight so that it's really easy to run on a Raspberry Pi and really easy to start up. But the trade-off is that it's only useful for one person, for one wallet. Like it's not useful. You can't have anyone connecting to it. It's only for your own personal use. Trying to think what other projects have I done. I think they're the three main ones that I'm like more famous for, I guess.
This is it's amazing that after all that, there's still some other stuff in the tank there. Like Len and I can barely get together like, you know, once a week to do this episode and put the audio out. And you're inventing stuff that as a Bitcoiner of the 2017 vintage, Chris, you know, these are things I've only heard about. You know, these are stories I've sort of touched on tangentially, learning about other things. And so, yeah, truly, you know, for people who are listening, maybe unfamiliar with some of this work, this is truly, you know, this is all cutting edge stuff and was cutting edge stuff at the time. Chris, I want to know, since you may be the man most qualified to discuss the, let's say, newfound prevalence of mixing in the Bitcoin space. There's been stories, I shouldn't even say stories. There's been developments lately with Wasabi compared to other coin joins and tumbling services, things of this nature. There's been developments in the analytics space, we'll say, about how to dissect and sort of destroy the anonymity set that comes with these services. What, as a, you know, as a dev, what is it that you see as far as the biggest threat to privacy? And if you want to, like, I don't want to get you in any trouble with the community, but I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on the Wasabi blacklist. For those who don't know, I think, you know, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, either one of you. Wasabi sort of volunteered to blacklist some transactions based on the advice, we'll say, of a third-party chain analytics firm. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts about that, Chris, from both a privacy standpoint and also from the point of a developer. I'm sure there's a lot of people who worked on that project who are not happy about it.
Yeah, it's really quite interesting, isn't it? So Wasabi is a wallet. I think it appeared first around 2018 or that kind of time. So it works by users of this wallet. When they can do a coin join. That's like the killer app of the product. They do a coin join by all connecting to one server together, and they all have to send the same amount. So the last time I checked, it was 0.1 Bitcoins, and they have to do a coin join for exactly this amount, and they can't do any other amount. And then they have these rounds where they wait, I think 5 minutes or a couple of seconds or that kind of thing. And all these wallets, 100 or so, connect together and they make a coin join, which is for 0.1 Bitcoin. And at the, you know, when the round is finished, when they have 100 or so users. So what actually happened is this, an important part is this Wasabi company, they make an income from that. So within the coin join, a small amount of Bitcoins goes to the company and that pays for their developers and their product and all that kind of thing, you know, that companies have. So what happened is this server that they all connect to, it can control the coin join in a sense. So when inputs come in, the server can like choose to accept them for the coin join or it can refuse them. So it seems what happened is the Wasabi company said that they will now analyze everyone's inputs, like use this transaction surveillance software, Chainalysis or someone else, to analyze all the inputs coming in. And if they're from entities that they want to censor, that they, I don't know, maybe they're from Russia or something like that, then they will not allow them to use, not allow them to create a coin join. And a lot of people aren't happy about this because Bitcoin's meant to be about privacy and censorship resistance and not caring which country you're from or that kind of thing. Not because we like love Russia or anything like that, but just because we think this technology should be neutral and it has value because anyone can use it regardless of borders or identity or that kind of thing. Now, I think that the reason this Wasabi is vulnerable to this kind of pressure, because probably what happened is maybe some regulator or someone said that they have to do this, it's because it's centralized. It's because you connect to one server. I can see why they did that, because they have to have an income. Like, you know, every company has to have a business model. So it's fair enough. They have this centralization in order to get the income and that's how it works. But then the downside is you have the centralized point of failure that you can just pressure. And then that's, I see it as a kind of an expected outcome of centralization, which is, you know, sad, but it is what it is. Yeah, and so I've always, in these technologies I've been working on, you have to go towards decentralization to have something which can't really be stopped in the way of just the central point of failure. Because there's an interesting thing. It's kind of funny in a sense that I spend most of my work on actual privacy, but I think a far more important property of Bitcoin, of the system, is censorship resistance, that you can really use it anywhere in the world without a central point of failure that can just be just turned off one day. Because there's a thing that not a lot of people know. There was actually a digital currency project back in the 90s called DigiCash, and it worked. It had some interesting cryptography, which doesn't matter right now, but a really important kind of feature of it was so private, it was actually information theoretic private, which meant even if you had an infinitely powerful computer, like a computer the size of the whole universe, you could still not spy on the users of DigiCash. So it was unbreakable kind of in a mathematical sense. It was really cool from that way. But it was centralized. It was based around one company, the DigiCash company. And when it went out of business, I think that happened in 1998, then all the DigiCash just disappeared. And your privacy was pointless because you couldn't use it anymore. So Bitcoin's real innovation is this decentralization, that it will just be there, you know, forever. It will work regardless of, you know, I could disappear tomorrow, you could disappear, and the thing will still be there in 50 years, 100 years, whatever.
What I find ironic is that they're moving ahead with forking the project there, yeah, from Wasabi. And so they're going to be able with through the fork, give the services to everybody, even the people that the Wasabi team are going to probably be denying services from. So it's awesome that there's a project moving forward to actually give everybody an opportunity to use their services, at least the forked services moving forward.
Someone else can make a different server somewhere else. Mm-hmm. Work, I guess. But there's a thing, aside from the centralization, a thing I never really liked about the Wasabi or the Whirlpool kind of way of doing things was that you're forced into these denominations. Like, you know, I need a coin join for 0.1 Bitcoins or for another amount, 0.05 maybe. And then I got the question of, like, maybe you have less than that amount, then you can't do a coin join at all. Or if you have loads of, if you have much more, say you had one Bitcoin or 10 Bitcoins or 100 Bitcoins, then you suddenly have to break it up into 0.1 Bitcoin amounts, which is like all your money's been broken up into like 1,000 pieces or 100 pieces, which is also not very practical to use. Like, people talk about fungibility, this idea that every unit of a currency should be equal to everything else. Like, that's one of the properties of money, which is a thing that people, when people work on privacy, they often want to improve the fungibility, because it means you can just hand over a note, you know, a banknote or a coin without thinking about it's needed for money. But another really important property of money is divisibility, right? The ability to take a money and chop it up into small pieces and collect them back together without any costs, without any problem. So, you know, for a simple example, you can never use cows as money, because if you have a big cow and I say, I want to pay for this coffee, and the coffee goes, okay, can I have like the cow's leg? And they have to chop off the cow's leg. And then at the end of the day, the coffee person, they get like loads of cow's legs, and you can never put it back into a whole cow. So it has to be something like, you know, people use cigarettes or gold or Bitcoins. Like, they're divisible. That's one of the good things about it. And the way these coin join products work, where when you're fixed in 0.1 Bitcoin, is it destroys that property. Like, it stops with your fixed of these amounts, and it's hard to do anything else. So that's one reason I don't like them. And just to point out that join market avoids this. So join market, you can make a coin join for any amount, and then you can really use it as money or different amounts of money.
This is really the important thing, that people have flexibility with these tools. I'm curious, Chris, what your thoughts are. I've asked this question of other guests, but again, we've not had a guest of your chops as far as development. I'm wondering if in your experience with the projects you've worked on, consulted on, helped with, when we talk about privacy in the Bitcoin space these days, it always seems to come with this, you know, sort of parasitic second thought about how much privacy is going to attract the wrong kind of attention. And we've seen that obviously with Wasabi. We saw that recently with protests in Canada. And I think we're going to continue to see it in Bitcoin. I'm curious about the mood and sort of propensity to meet this with a tempered set of privacy tools by developers. Is it true or rational for me to assume that developers think about privacy in a way that is sort of, you know, pushing right to the edge of something that's too private and then pulling back so as not to attract the wrong kind of attention? Or do developers and these community building communities often just say, we can make this as good as possible. It doesn't matter if it goes a bit too far, if it crosses a line that previously attracted the wrong kind of attention, we're going to do it anyway. What is the thinking around that in the community? I've always been curious about where the line is for people doing that kind of work.
Well, I suppose it depends on the person. You'd have to ask everyone. But I can tell you what I think is that for a long time, I've kind of imagined one kind of cool, you know, sort of sci-fi use is you can use Bitcoin to help people in dictatorships. And this actually happened. I read a thing, and there was also a podcast about it, of protesters in Belarus. Maybe you follow this. This was at the end of 2020. There was an election in Belarus, which was like clearly rigged. I think the guy won like 110% of the votes or something like that. And then there were protests on the streets, people who wanted Belarus to be a democracy and that kind of thing. And it was really interesting. So the way Belarus works, the impression I got is that it's all quite state-run. So a lot of jobs are actually state jobs. Like there's a factory and it's actually run by the government, and then shopping malls and that kind of thing, they're all run by the government. So if the government finds that you're a protester, you know, you're wanting to change things, then they could just make you lose your job. You know, you lose your job and that's that, and there's no recourse. So a lot of these protesters were actually getting, there was some kind of help from, there was a charity in the West which would actually send them Bitcoin, like they wanted to send them money to help these people, tide them over until they learn a new skill or move to a new area or something like that. And the only way to do this was Bitcoin. Like you can't send them money with like suitcases of cash because the Belarusian government will like find it at the border, and you'd do a bank transfer because the Belarusian banks will just stop it. So it worked with Bitcoin that these protesters would get, like the charity would tell them, download this, you know, smartphone wallet, and then they'd get Bitcoins in the country. They could sell them for cash in person. Also, Belarus was having an economic crisis at the time, so lots of people actually wanted to buy Bitcoin to protect themselves from inflation. So it was quite easy to get the currency. So this is like a really great example of something that you really want to use. You know, you could say using privacy to attract the wrong kind of attention, but in that situation, you really want that. So, you know, the Belarusian state, it's like a horrible dictatorship. They do loads of unpleasant things. And obviously, you really need privacy. So in this example, so imagine if the Belarusian government could see, like they catch one protester and they see he has this smartphone wallet with Bitcoin on it. And they say, okay, so what if we took that Bitcoin address and figured out where it all came from? And we could find all the other protesters that also received Bitcoins from this charity. That would obviously be really negative. So, because, you know, they could just go and catch them easily. So you'd really want a good privacy system for all of them, that each of these protesters can accept the help without their privacy being destroyed and them all ending up in jail. I see, and that's kind of my perspective. I've also had thoughts for a long time, and not just me. This used to be on the Bitcoin Wiki, an example of a hypothetical example, as far as I'm aware, of in China somebody running like a kind of a internet media outlet, like a blog or a podcast or that kind of thing, and which talks about things that the Chinese government doesn't like, I don't know, Tiananmen Square or something like that. And they could fundraise with Bitcoin. Clearly it'd be good privacy for that. Otherwise they'll end up in prison. As I see it, they'd, you know, the wrong kind of attention. I mean, it's from the point of view of who, like, you know, some things that they think is the wrong kind of attention. We in the West, at least where I am right now, we think that's the right kind of attention. You want that those kind of systems to be broken down. So that's the way I see it.
That's a great explanation. Yeah, that's rock solid.
And I want to change the focus to the project you're working on, the CoinSwap project. And you did a very good job of talking about coin joins and the technicalities behind that and some of the pros and cons with that. Can you give us a breakdown? What are the differences between CoinSwap and the CoinJoin projects that are currently in the wild right now? Give us the pros and cons, the differences, and try not to be too technical because
be technical. This is important stuff. And honestly, you know, one of the ways you learn about this type of project, this type of tool, is you just immerse yourself, right? You go full immersion, try and pick up some of the terminology as you go. And I think that this, honestly, that's what we need, Chris, is more people understanding really how these things work so they can make these sorts of judgments on their own if they have to. So please, yeah, go ahead.
Okay. So the difference between CoinJoin and CoinSwap is they're both privacy protocols. They both intend to somehow hide and protects people's data, protects people's privacy. So the way CoinJoin works is it's many people, maybe 10 or 50 or that kind of number, come together to create one Bitcoin transaction. So what's happening is their transaction history, their transaction graph, is being all merged together. And the privacy increase comes from all the people. Like if 50 people take part in a CoinJoin, then you could say your anonymity set, the number of people you could be confused with, is 50. And then if you make the CoinJoin bigger, if you make it 100, now your anonymity set is 100. Mm-hmm. So that has like one difference there with CoinJoin and CoinSwap is the anonymity set's a bit smaller. It's as big as your transaction. As many people you can go into this one transaction will be your anonymity set in CoinJoin. Well, in CoinSwap, a special thing of CoinSwap is the transactions can look just like regular transactions. They can look like a Bitcoin starts in one address and goes into another address. And then with this magic of how CoinSwap works, that the actual possession ends up in a totally third place that's unconnected, which means if an analyst actually looks at the address on the blockchain, they look normal. These CoinSwaps, they don't look any different from any other address. And that means the anonymity set is everyone else who just uses Bitcoin normally. And if you look at like one Bitcoin block, they normally have about 2,000 transactions happening within 10 minutes. That means in one day you have maybe 50,000 transactions. That means if your coin swap happens over the period of one day, you have 50,000 like people that you can be confused with. And what did I say earlier for CoinJoin? You have maybe 50 or 100. So that's a big difference. The anonymity set for CoinSwap is much bigger than for CoinJoin. So that's a big kind of advantage why a lot of people are interested in it. Another advantage is these coin joins, these transactions, they look quite different. So they're bigger and they have a lot of inputs kind of going in and then a lot of inputs going out. And the pattern of the outputs is special, like they're quite recognizable. So if an analyst is looking at these transactions, they can say, aha, this is clearly a coin join. And then we maybe can't break it, but we can treat it differently or try and like find a side channel to break it. But with CoinSwap, because the transactions look the same, they're really easy to miss. Like even transactions which just look normal could be confusing to the analyst, or maybe the analyst won't know if the analyst is doing analysis on normal transactions, they always have a doubt in the back of their head, oh, maybe this is actually a CoinSwap and then my analysis is all wrong. So I think that are two big differences, that CoinJoin has a small anonymity set for a transaction and it's recognizable. Well, CoinSwap is, you can have really, really big anonymity sets, i.e. everyone who uses Bitcoin at the same time. And they're also, they're unrecognizable. They're hidden in a sense.
Could you explain a little bit about the teleport part? Because I've seen this written in the mm-hmm. GitHub documents and wondering if you could just dive a little bit more into that teleport part.
Yeah, so teleport is the name I've given the project. It's a bit like a brand name, but also people use it to say the coins have kind of teleported to somewhere else. So I'll explain how that works kind of technically is that suppose there's Alice and Bob, and they're going to do a coin swap between them. So what Alice will do is she'll send her coins into a 2-of-2 multi-signature address. And the keys, the private keys, one of the keys will be owned by Alice and the other one will be owned by Bob. So now they're kind of locked up in a 2-of-2. And now before that happened, Alice will ask Bob to make a transaction which spends those coins from the 2-of-2 multisig and sends them into a smart contract. So it would happen like this. It kind of the maybe easy to see in the diagram, but if this transaction was broadcast, the coins would end up in a contract. And the contract says this. It says either after a timeout, let's call it one day, the coins will be back to possessed only by Alice. Or if Bob shows a secret, like we call it hash pre-image, if Bob shows this secret, he can spend the coins immediately. So it would happen like this. Alice puts coins in a 2-2 multisig, and she knows that within one day, she can always get her coins back. So in a sense, she always has control of them. But within that one day, Bob can get the coins if he knows the secret. Then Bob does the same thing, but like a mirror image. So he'll send coins into a different 2-of-2 multisig, and there'll be a different contract, which stays not broadcast, and it has the mirror image, and it means the coins will go back to Bob after one day. Sorry, in fact, they'll go back to Bob after like half a day, less time. But if Alice shows a secret, she can get those coins immediately. So what's happened here means both Alice and Bob have both send these coins into the 2-of-2 multisigs. If it turns out something goes wrong, maybe Bob's like power cuts out and he can no longer connect to the internet, then Alice and Bob can both get their coins back. They just have to wait one day or half a day or something. But if the secret is revealed, which is, it's just like a random number, it's a secret, then they can get the other person's coins immediately without any waiting. So this is kind of, it's a smart contract. Like, it's kind of guaranteed that no one's going to lose any money doing this. They might, you know, have to wait for a day. And because this kind of sets up an incentive that people know they won't be cheated. So then what they'll do, like these softwares programmed to do this, they'll just send the coins over anyway without using these broadcasted smart contracts. And that will mean that, what that means then is that Alice will send these coins into a multisig address and they'll just become owned by Bob. And Bob will send his coins into a multisig address and they'll become owned, they'll become possessed by Alice. So in that way, the coins have been swapped. But it also means that anyone looking at the blockchain will not see anything. They'll just see coins going into and out of addresses with nothing special really happening. Hmm. That's how the thing works.
That is so sick, man. I can't wait. Like, I remember in high school, elementary school, for the little time that I spent paying attention in math class, I was always like disappointed that the only Alice and Bob questions in the book were about Alice and Bob buying hundreds of apples and oranges, hundreds of kiwis and pears, and trying to figure out, you know, how many trips to the grocery store. This is the kind of Alice and Bob question we need to get in math books. Like, that is a sick, sick implementation. And, you know, one of the things, Chris, that I wanted to ask you today, and I may as well ask it now, because there's a lot of people, and I would include myself in you know, among them. I'm going to have to listen back to this episode and, like, really think about and look into some of the stuff you're saying to clarify, because I'm not a technical person. And many people, I think, who are, you know, same technical level as me and maybe not as friendly toward Bitcoin would say, well, look, you know, you could talk to Chris about this for half an hour, or you could just buy Monero or other privacy coin. What are the shortcomings in these privacy coins in your view, as far as the way they serve that ultimate, you know, that killer app, the privacy killer app, in a way that maybe your implementation or other implementations on Bitcoin could do better or are doing better?
All right. So first to be one thing I should be clear about is when this is finished, people won't need to understand anything I just said. It's the same with the joint market today. They, in theory, you could just download it on your smartphone or something like that and press send, and all this happens in the background and the user doesn't know or care and it just happens. In a similar way, like I could, if I wanted to, talk about how Bitcoin's digital signature scheme works, which involves like elliptic curves and hash functions, that kind of thing, and know what, you know, you don't need to know that. You just press the button send and it works. So it's if people find this like hard, then it doesn't matter. You can just press a button, it will still work.
You should be telling them they got to learn. That's what I'm telling listeners and viewers. You must learn. Don't wait for the send button. That's one thing I wish I would have done earlier. Anyway, Chris, go ahead. Talk to me about it.
Depends on the situation. Like those Belarusian protesters I was thinking of, I'd prefer they're like, you know, they're probably interested in democracy and not being in a dictatorship, and there's no point them like sitting down and looking at hash functions and stuff right now. Maybe to Monero, that has its own scheme of how it works, is that a thing called ring signatures, but it's also like, you can talk about how that works mathematically. But the thing it actually does is it makes every transaction, like transactions have these inputs and outputs. What Monero does is it has transactions have inputs which are nothing to do with the actual user. So they're mixed into the same transaction, but it's not possible to prove which one of these inputs is owned by the actual user, which then improves privacy, because then each input, like it will be spent in many, many transactions, and anyone analyzing the blockchain won't know which is the actual real transaction. So all the graphs will be mixed up. Now, the downside of that is that, firstly, it uses a lot of computational power. It uses CPU and memory and that kind of thing. So that has a downside that when you run a Monero full node, I'm sure you're aware how important it is for privacy and security for Bitcoin users to use a full node wallet, because that's checking every transaction that happens on the network all the time. Now, Monero full node, it's about 10 times less efficient, or between 10 and 20 times less efficient than Bitcoin. So Monero is actually smaller as a system. Like it has a hard, you know, a cap on how many transactions it can have on its blockchain per 10 minutes or per 2 minutes or however much it is. And you can actually do the maths. Like I've done this on the Monero subreddit to explain to people, and I never really got a reply because it, you know, destroyed their altcoin. But if you scaled up Monero to the same kind of volume as Bitcoin, then it would not be possible to run it on a normal computer. So like I have a laptop here right now, which can run a Bitcoin full node, you know, easily. But if Monero scaled out to the same scale as Bitcoin, my laptop or, you know, a normal computer could not run it. It's just too expensive. The CPU would be, you need like a big beefy server to do it. So what Monero gains in privacy, it's actually traded off for efficiency. which is obviously not good because decentralization, as I said before, is the most important thing here. You need full nodes which are really cheap, which you can run them over, you know, like old hardware that's easy to get everywhere and where the internet's not, you know, doesn't use too much internet bandwidth. Another thing that happens with Monero is, I'm sure you're aware, Bitcoin has pruning. So you can delete, once the full node has downloaded the whole blockchain, it can delete the old blocks and it uses much less data, like it, you know, a few gigabytes, something that's really easy. And Monero can't do that. So all these inputs that I told you about, because it doesn't know which inputs actually spent, it can never delete them. They always have to hang around on the hard drive forever. And that means that it would be as if Bitcoin didn't have pruning. Is this blockchain, you'd have to store it on your disk and it'll perpetually grow. So today's Bitcoin blockchain is about 450 gigabytes and that will just keep on growing and growing. Luckily, we can delete it, but with Monero, you can't delete it. So you'd always have to, every, you know, smartphone, every, all of this, every Raspberry Pi node would just have to have a disk that gets bigger and bigger and bigger and they can never get rid of it. So that's kind of another resource cost that adds to the centralization. But really, I think a bigger reason why they're like a dead end, these privacy coins, is they're a different coin. They're a different, Bitcoin is so widely used. For example, these Belarusian protesters, like they weren't taking Monero, they were taking the first currency, which is Bitcoin. Like then they could easily get rid of it. They could go on the street and find someone else who wanted Bitcoin and get cash for it straight away. And for the Monero, I don't like, where do you, that it's just way less, you know, there's way less penetration of it in society and users in kind of, what's it called, thought, you know, in mental space. There's just less of it. So this is what I'm talking about is the network effect, that the biggest currency or the biggest, it could be something else, like biggest protocol is the one that will get all the more users. And really, that's kind of the one we're stuck with. We have to improve privacy on Bitcoin. That's where we are. And, you know, jumping to a different protocol, a different coin will not get us anywhere because you have such a big uphill struggle against Bitcoin's already dominant position.
Yeah. You don't want to meet anybody that is using Monero. you don't want to run into anyone that's.
It's so great that he's got a story about going to the Monero subreddit and explaining the problems. There's crickets over there.
Yeah, I can link it. I've got it all saved somewhere in a text file. Like, the people ever ask me about Monero, but it's funny because one person commented saying, "Yeah, you know, I'm going to check these sums that you just said, and I'll get back to you." And, course, he never did, but.
See you later.
Cool. I mean, this is, it's a problem for Bitcoin as well. Like, you know, the resource usage is a thing. On Satoshi's first email, people said, "Oh, he uses a lot of resources." And one of the ways we solve that is with second layers. So Lightning Network is a kind of second layer. And the way CoinSwap works is it's actually a kind of a semi-second layer protocol, which is another advantage over CoinJoin, is that CoinSwap actually costs less in miner fees because it uses less resources than CoinJoin for the same amount of privacy. And as far as I can tell, Monero actually can't use Lightning because of some detail of their cryptography. I don't believe it's actually possible to use Lightning on Monero. So then they don't benefit from that efficiency trade-off either.
It's a good thing we're not the Monero, because we're the Canadian Monero orders. Because
never.
Yeah. No, but I want to talk a little bit about your project CoinSwap. And from what I understand, it's not fully yet ready for use. You're doing using it on testnet and signet, from what I understand. Have you even tried using it on the main net or the main chain as of yet?
I have not, but it's because I'm not, like, there's no, because I'm like working on it, testing and programming on it, there's no benefit. Like, the testnet network and signet network is basically the same as Bitcoin, but with the benefit that if something goes wrong, you haven't lost real money. But I did imagine maybe somebody who works on it could, like, do a mainnet coin swap just to say that they were the first one, if you know what I mean. And maybe, I don't know, we'll see. But it's not, like, in terms of development and technical, it's not necessary except for bragging rights.
Chris, as you continue to work on the project, you know, we've had on this show, much to the chagrin of some of our listeners, viewers, and probably also you as well, if I'm being honest, we've had some people from companies who do chain analytic work. And, you know, in the interest of getting both sides of the story, often we just ask them, you know, how do you, you know, we use more diplomatic language than this, but the question is basically, how do you sleep at night knowing that you're, you know, eroding privacy for the general population? You know, how is your head at the pillow? And how do you feel good about that? And the story is always the same, that the privacy aspect of Bitcoin is only intact as long as they can stay ahead of the sort of counterparties that are making money on decoding the privacy, you know, and destroying the privacy. And so I'm wondering, as you're working on the project, you don't have to give away any, you know, trade secrets or details here, but are you looking at the ways that other implementations, privacy-related implementations, have failed when you're thinking about how to sort of put the finishing touches on the stuff you're doing? Or do you just, you know, sort of bulldoze with as much firepower as you can and leave the ball in the court of the people who are trying to undo you on the other end?
No, yeah, I think about it. You have to think about all the everything that came before and what things have tried before. Like, there's a big kind of benefit of how CoinSwap works. Like, if you look at it on a fundamental level, it works by removing information from the blockchain. That there's this transaction graph and it's just not recorded. And that's where some of the efficiency comes from, because it's not like this is data that you don't have to pay a miner fee for. And that's different to how CoinJoin and Monero work, because they work by adding more information to the blockchain. So that means more data, more, you know, blockchain space that has to be relayed, and miner fees have to be paid for it. And that inherently makes the system less efficient and less scalable. So yeah, definitely, for sure. Like, as technology moves forward, you learn from previous mistakes. And yeah, it's interesting with these surveillance companies. Like, there's a whole a thing I've noticed now, and we've kind of used them. Like, if somebody sends Bitcoins to an exchange and they get frozen because of something, is there a concerning thing is there's no kind of mechanism for oversight. So what could happen is somebody could have, I don't know, in the worst case, someone could have their coins confiscated, saying, oh, these came from Russia or something. And then there's no, like, where's the judge and jury there? Like, can you appeal against that? As far as I can tell, there's no way to appeal. And also, their algorithms are actually a trade secret. Like, you don't even know if you're a victim. You don't know, like, what you're being accused of. You can never figure out. So it in that kind of sense, it goes against kind of I'm not a lawyer, but it goes against how kind of justice works, as far as I can tell. And yeah, you've talked to those ones, like, they're doing it, I presume, in Canada or where they're from, but I'm sure there's chain analysis companies in China and in Russia who are doing, you know, much worse things to their people. Like, they analyze everything they can do all the time. So yeah, I agree with you about how did I sleep.
Yeah. I got a question to do with Taproot. And
yeah.
Is this complicating your goal from implementing or developing your project, your CoinSwap project? Because I'm wondering how much of a hurdle, or even if it's helping you, is Taproot, is it something that's good for your project, or if it's something that's creating a little bit of a headache for you?
No, it's definitely good for my project and for privacy in general. I think when Taproot was being activated, I was kind of involved a little bit in the debates of how exactly to add it to Bitcoin, the activation process. So the way it helps CoinSwap directly is, if you remember, I talked about these smart contracts, which they'll appear on the blockchain in the worst case, in the unhappy case, like if his internet stops working, if he gets a power cut. So these contracts, they'll appear, they'll be like written. You'll see if a timeout happens, the coins go here. If a secret is revealed, they go to the other place. Now, what Taproot allows us to do is it allows us to completely hide that. So that in this unhappy case in CoinSwap, if Bob's gets a power cut, through the use of Taproot, these contracts can actually be invisible. They can look the same as any other Taproot output out there. And they use a thing called, it's sometimes called adapter signatures, or it's also called crypto scripts. It's also called point time lock contracts. And that's this idea that you can have smart contracts which are hidden in a way that they just use the mathematical properties of how Taproot works. So yeah, they're really good. And then other projects outside from CoinSwap also use this, and it's really great, like in Lightning and in other things.
We got a couple questions left for you. One that, you know, has been on my mind in the last little while, given all the stuff that's going on in Canada and around the world. What, you know, and this may be sort of an unfair question because you didn't prep for it, and I don't really know where you'll go with it, but I hope you'll take us as far as you can. The average sure. Bitcoiner, let's say, you know, been in Bitcoin for a year, you have a hardware wallet, you know, you got a Ledger, Trezor, whatever. What sort of measures can you take to enhance the privacy heuristics of your Bitcoin transactions for the average user without, you know, a lot of technical know-how? Let's say they don't even run a node. What would you tell these people about how to protect their privacy with the coins they've already amassed? And, you know, what tools would you recommend for them? What easy or I guess low friction methods for polishing this stuff up would you suggest?
So there's a big, you said they might not use a node. Probably the biggest, or not, maybe not even that hard thing that someone could do is run their own node. So the way you can do that, there's a few of these projects which are kind of like a node in a box. It's like a Raspberry Pi or a similar small computer that you can obtain. You can install the software on it. I've been led to believe it's really quite easy. And you plug it in, and it kind of stays in a corner in your closet. And the reason that works really well for privacy is if you don't do that, if you have a hardware wallet like a Ledger or Treasure or Cold Card, when you connect to the way you use them is you like plug them into a computer, and your computer will connect to the Ledger, for example. They'll connect to their server, and your hardware wallet will tell all its Bitcoin addresses to this server, and the server will reply with its balance and history. And therefore, the server can very easily spy on you because it knows all your Bitcoin addresses. Even if you do, you know, loads of stuff, if you do things like, you know, not reveal your identity when you buy them, the server will still know your real computer, your real IP address, and your Bitcoin address, and they'll know all the amounts and where you send them, where you receive from. So that's probably what I'd recommend first, is for the user to run their own full node wallet. And there's these solutions I mentioned. I think there's one called Umbral, then there's one called Raspberry Blitz, and there's a few like that, and they're really quite good, I've heard. So probably the second thing you could do, so right now there's a lot of, especially when you go to exchanges which are big and centralized, they'll ask you all kinds of personal information that invades your privacy. They'll ask you your name, where you live, that kind of thing. It's called KYC. And if you can avoid that, so if you can borrow or sell Bitcoin peer-to-peer without giving up this information, then you're already a big step ahead, because these, when you have these Bitcoins on their addresses, they won't be linked to you in a big database full of loads of privacy-relevant information. I actually remember a concrete example, Ledger, I think it was 2 years ago or a while ago now, that they had a big database of people using like the names and addresses of everyone they'd sold the hardware wallet to. And this database was actually hacked. It was leaked and it appeared on 4chan or something like that. And you had then people showing up on like the Bitcoin Reddit saying, oh my God, you know, my address is on this list and everyone can see it. And they know I have, you know, my life savings or whatever, half of my life savings on this, you know, in my house right here. I'm going to get robbed. This is terrible. And I remember a really actually quite scary situation of some guy who lived in Brazil in a favela, like in, you know, what, like the poor areas of town where there's loads of violence and crime and stuff. And he says, oh my God, you know, I wanted Bitcoin to have something that can't easily be stolen, but if they're going to break into my house and take it, especially because his address is right there, right, on this leak. So I always wonder what happened to that guy and if he got robbed. But yeah, like the privacy thing is not just, you know, we all have big fantasies about against Russia, against China, whatever, but it can just be against the guy next door who's going to steal your money. So those are two things. If you can avoid KYC, you can avoid identifying yourself when you trade, and if you can avoid sending all your addresses to some random server out there by using your own full node. If people could you know, take one thing from this podcast, then consider those two things.
Before you leave, I have to ask you this question. Thoughts on Tor and even VPNs? Is this something that we should be using more, or we should be running away from them? I'd love to hear your thoughts on those.
Chris, I have a follow up to that before you even answer that. In terms of like the control sets that you mentioned earlier, when you're doing CoinSwap, CoinJoin, whatever, right? Even the Taproot control set, right? Like certain things look different on chain than others. And so one thing I've heard about Tor, to Len's question, is that it's almost easier to identify a Tor connection if there's only one or two Tor connections. Is that true as well? I really have no idea, but I've heard this a few times. I'm wondering if you have any insight on that.
Yeah, okay. So I'll briefly talk about VPNs, which I think are not that very good of an idea. So VPNs work by taking your internet connection and sending it to just one server, like the VPN provider, and then they send it to the website you're looking at. And that's not probably because the one server can just see everything you do. So for privacy, it's not that great. So I'll leave that aside. I don't think that useful. Now, Tor is very good. It generally does provide privacy. The way it works is it has these, and people can read up, but it's these encrypted blobs and they're encrypted on different layers, hence the onion router. And it goes through by default three hops, and each hop opens one layer, like of an onion. And when your data gets to the final layer, it will send it on to the destination, like to some website or whatever you're connecting. Don't know where the data either came from or where it's going, and because of this encryption, it protects because of that. So Tor, it genuinely does work. Now, you asked about whether the traffic itself can be identifying, and yes, it is, because it looks like it's encrypted and you can't an ISP or something. They can't see the data in. They can clearly see that it's Tor data. So then there is a case. So firstly, people use Tor for loads of different reasons. Like there's, I've heard about journalists using it when they're in a country where they have to not be detected. Or I've read about like hedge funds and banks using Tor because they want to read about, I don't know, if they're trading on wheat futures, they want to read about them without their ISP figuring out that the bank is interested in wheat futures, if you see what I mean. That's important in finance. Or you have people, one thing I do is I connect to my own full node, which is in my home, over Tor, because that's like, it's kind of a NAT. So it's a kind of, it means I don't have to open a port to the whole internet, but I just open a Tor hidden service, and that works much better. So lots of people use Tor for very many, many different things, for getting around censorship in their own country or for really like mundane reasons. So that means, therefore, if like someone sees Tor traffic, it doesn't immediately mean that they are, you know, some kind of, I don't know, like a freedom fighter against the government or something like that. Like there could be loads of mundane reasons. So people don't have to kind of fear Tor as something that's like any criminals use, which is, that's not true at all. Now, there was a situation to be aware about that using Tor can be a, it kind of lights up, it does reveal that you're using Tor. So there was a situation a few years ago. This is kind of funny and stupid. I think it may have actually been a Canadian university. There was some years in university somewhere in America where a student didn't study for an exam. And on the morning for the exam, he logged on to Tor and I think sent an email or some kind of message that was like a bomb threat that said, you know, I'm going to blow up the exam hall. And then they you know, closed the school, closed the university, and then because you'd have to take bomb threat seriously. But then what was pretty, the reason this kid got caught is because he was using the university internet, and then the IT department just looked at who was using Tor at exactly this time when the message appeared, like, you know, 8:30 a.m. on a Monday, and it was just one guy, or maybe it was two people, and they just went to their dormitory room and knocked on the door and, you know, and said, hey, did you, you know, ask some questions? And of course the kid like confessed everything. So then he got in trouble. So when they're very, very small groups, like a university where there's maybe only a few hundred people, depending on how big it is, then you don't have much anonymity because very few of them are going to use Tor. But on the level of the country, on the level of the whole world, the privacy is quite good because a lot of people do use Tor for many different reasons.
I like that answer. That's good. That's a good story. If you're ever thinking about, you know, doing something crazy, chances are you didn't really have to study as much as you think anyway. So just go to the exam. It's not that big a deal. Also, no one's ever asked to see my diploma. So who cares? Chris, okay, last question for you. You've been a great guest. So we try and ask a fun question off the beaten path here at the end of the show. Do you think that on a sunny day in a parking lot, you know, if there was a finish line, a checkered flag about 40 yards from where you're standing in your favorite pair of Nikes, shorts, whatever, do you think you could beat Luke Dasher in a 40-yard foot race? And if you could, how much do you could beat him by?
I don't know. I'm not sure what to say. I think you'd probably win, to be honest. Because I've got some issues right now. I have some trouble walking. I had a sports injury. So
What do you got? What happened to you?
I had some operation on my knee, which I'm recovering from, and then means I can't walk very much. I'm probably not, definitely not run for 40 yards, as you said. So Luke would probably win on that count.
Well, we have to ask. Listen, if we ever get Luke on the show, we'll wait until you're recovered. Okay, I'm a knee injury recovery myself, and I'll tell you, it'll get better, and we'll have this conversation again sometime in the future. Chris Belcher, you've been a great guest. Tell people where they can find you, where they can look in on what you're doing, and Mike's all yours.
Yeah, so I'm I work on these projects which are decentralized, which we don't have a funding model. So if people want to support me financially, there's a website which is bitcoinprivacy.me/coinswap-donations. That will be a Bitcoin address if you want to support me financially. Other than that, I'm on Twitter and it will be Chris_Belcher_. And I'm also on Reddit. I'm one of the moderators of the Bitcoin subreddit, which is u/Belcher_. And you can send me a message there or anything like that. Or what else? Yeah, there's a few. I'm on the Bitcoin Wiki. I sometimes write things there, so you can send me a message on that too if you like. And yeah, so that's
page for the donations. He's the busiest man in the decentralized finance right here.
Yeah. the donation, I put the link in the show notes for description of this YouTube chat.
Yeah,
YouTube video, so, and it's also, we'll put it in the notes for the audio version so people
it'll be everywhere. It. Highly recommend supporting Chris's work. This is important stuff. You're not going to know you need it until you need it. And so you damn well better help the guy build it for you, because you're going to need it at some point. That is the only certainty. Chris Belcher, thanks for coming on, brother. We appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers, man.
Yeah, thank you.